the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Thank you. Right, we are working our way through Daniel, as you know. We've reached Daniel chapter 5. Interestingly, when I was looking to see what other people had written or said about Daniel chapter 5, it's quite interesting in sermon series in other churches. They go from 4 to 6. Just bring on the lions, please. Bring on the lions. We won't worry about 5 so much. But 5 is really interesting. We're going to spend some time looking at it. It's page 844. We're going to read it in chunks. We're going to, if you don't know the story, then the story will be revealed as you go through, because we're not going to read it in one part. We're going to think about it, read a bit, think about it, etc., as we go through. Now, if you've been here for the first 4 talks, you'll already know something of the context into which the stories are set. For those of you who perhaps are just joining us, or for those with very short memories like me, a little bit of reminder, then that this part of the story that we're considering takes place in Babylon. We're some 50 miles south of modern-day Baghdad. And this happens during the latter half of 539 BC. In fact, the very end of the story we're going to read, historians tell us, happened on October the 12th. 539. So it's quite nice, isn't it, that people can be that precise. Now, by this time, Daniel has been living in Babylon for over 50 years. So he is now late 70s, pushing on into probably early 80s at this point. He's no longer a young man. And the reason why, if you remember, he's lived the greater part of his life in Babylon is it's not the city of his birth, of course. Jerusalem was the city of his birth, some 1,000 miles away. It's because Daniel, along with several of his friends, including Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who we read about a couple of Sundays ago, have been forcibly removed, deported from their home city, and taken to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar during the conquest of Judah by the Babylonian Empire. And Daniel, in the intervening years, has been a busy man. He's been very busy. He served faithfully as the administrator and advisor to the royal household. Now, just before we dive into the passage, there's one more historical note that's worth mentioning before we look at the story. Now, historical records that exist in addition to the Bible record Belshazzar as ruling co-regent with his father, Nabonius. Now, Nabonius was the husband of Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. I hope you've got that. It appears that Belshazzar ruled over the capital city and its immediate provinces, whilst his father ruled over the rest of the empire. Now, there's a reason for mentioning that, as you'll see when we get there, because we need to make sense of some of the references. We see references to son and father that appear in the text, but if you've got good eyesight and you look down to the bottom in the notes, you'll see that it says that those words can mean successor, descendant, or ancestor. And it also makes a lot of sense, as you'll see in a minute, as to why Belshazzar promises a reward to someone who can interpret the writing on the wall and will make them, he says, the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Interestingly, because his father, Nabonius, is ruling further afield than Babylon, Belshazzar is ruling in Babylon and in the provinces. The third ruler, of course, would be really the third most important person then in the kingdom. Over the summer period in our evening services, we're going to be looking at several scriptures that have inspired iconic works of art. It's a series that we've entitled Seeing Salvation. And the story of Daniel chapter 5 inspired the 15th century Dutch artist Rembrandt to paint this picture. And it's currently hanging in the National Gallery in London if you want to go and see it. And I think it's an evocative and imposing image. It's painted on a canvas which, in fact, is over 2 meters long. So it is quite a big picture. And I think it captures very well the moment that we're going to read about, when a drunken king sees the disembodied hand of God writing on the wall of his banqueting hall. So let's read something together, shall we? We're going to read from Daniel chapter 5. Let's read the first 9 verses together. 844 is the page in the church Bible if you're using it. This is what we read. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to them, "Wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So Belshazzar became even more terrified. His face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Okay, we'll stop there for a minute. We're going to think about this story under three headings. We're going to think blasphemy, prophecy, and mystery. So here's the first one. Blasphemy, the God he would not honor. Now, if you cast your mind back to the first part of our series, you recall that it was Nebuchadnezzar who removed the sacred items from the temple in Jerusalem. We find that right at the beginning of chapter 1. But he brought them to Babylon, and not without a certain amount of religious respect, he placed them in his treasure house. But Belshazzar has no respect at all for these items. He orders them in his drunken state to be removed from the treasure house, to be brought to the banqueting hall, to be used as part of a drunken toast. And it's a drunken toast that he makes to, and you notice it in verse 4, the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So in an act of sort of belligerent disregard for the God of Israel, the only true God, Belshazzar commits a defiant act of blasphemy. And King Belshazzar's actions in these verses reveal something of his indulgence and his indifference and his irreverence. Even though the enemy is at the gates, quite literally, as we'll see later, King Belshazzar thinks only about his pleasure. His only concern is his own status. He has no time whatsoever to honor God. He has no thought whatsoever for tomorrow. He is the personification of the pursuit of what John writes about in his first letter as the cravings of sinful people, the lust of their eyes, and their boasting about what they have and do. And John goes on in the end of that verse. He says, "The world and its desires pass away, but whoever does the will of God lives forever." Now, quite recently, there was a charge of blasphemy made in the Irish courts against Stephen Fry. He was appearing in a TV show entitled The Meaning of Life, which was hosted by Gay Byrne. And he was asked, what would he want to say? What was the question he would most want to say to God if he could? And this was Fry's reply, and this is what got him into trouble. "How dare you," this is what he would say to God, "how dare you create a world in which there is such misery? It's not our fault, it's not right, it's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain?" It was a reply to Byrne's question that caused a little bit of outrage in some quarters. And the case never reached court. It never reached court because Fry said he wasn't actually targeting his comment on any God in particular or any particular religion. And therefore, he said, there was no injured party. And so it never got to court. But it was a case of blasphemy. And whatever we may think about Fry's comment, I'm constantly challenged to consider about whether through my actions or my words, I at times misrepresent God. So could it be that every time I do something or I say something that gives others a false representation of the glory and the holiness of the authority and the character of God, do I, in a sense, commit blasphemy? And is it blasphemy when I choose to replace God on the throne of my life, when I choose to just misplace my understanding of the security that I have in Christ, and I deflect all of the worship that's due solely to him onto all the things that Belshazzar says are made of gold and silver, of bronze, of iron, and wood and stone? Do I deflect the honor of God onto things that I have made, I have accumulated, the possessions, or whatever it may be? Now, thankfully, of course, if in a sense that is true to some measure or another, I know for certain that my case, the case against me, won't bring me to court. That's because of this, because of what we're about to share in a minute, because of what Christ did for us. I know, I can be sure that my case won't come to court because I've been forgiven. But what I do need to do is to come back to God, come back to the God who forgives and loves. I need to come back to the God who rescues and saves. I need to come back to the God whose spirit indwells me, the one who loves me despite my failures. And I need to say, and I need to do exactly what John's encouraged us to do this morning. I need to say sorry and ask for his forgiveness. And once again, as we read, didn't we, in the earlier chapters of what we've looked at in Daniel, the king's enchanters, the astrologers, the diviners, they're all powerless when it comes to what the king wants to know. So let's read on a little bit more, shall we, in our story. Let's read from verse 10. We'll go down to the first part of 13. Then we'll jump on to verse 16 and go on to the middle part, probably, of verse 23. So a little bit of a chunk. Let's go. So the queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems. Call for Daniel. He will tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king. Down to verse 16. "Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." "Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from the temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze and iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. Okay, so this is our second point for this morning. The first was blasphemy, the second is prophecy. You know, last week when we looked into chapter 4, you remember that Johnny just helped us to unpack the story of King Nebuchadnezzar's decline into mental illness and his subsequent recovery. And an event that saw, of course, not only his health restored at the end of chapter 4, but also he was restored to my throne and became greater than ever before, he writes. And Johnny reminded us that the central problem that beset the king, the one thing that threatens to undermine each of our relationships with God, is the sin of pride. And Nebuchadnezzar's journey took him from the point of claiming that everything in both his life and in his kingdom came about solely by his own doing, by his own achievements. And he came to the point, eventually, of course, where he recognizes that God is God. That he, King Nebuchadnezzar, is nothing in comparison with God. And it's God that appointed him king. And now Daniel, some decades later, he takes the story of Nebuchadnezzar and he reminds Belshazzar of God's power. God had brought Nebuchadnezzar to that point of realization in a dramatic way. This is what he says. Let's read it again. He was deposed of his royal throne, stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people. He was given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of the earth. But in contrast, whereas Nebuchadnezzar has come to that point of realization, the current king, despite the fact, as Daniel says, you knew all this, has made no effort whatsoever to turn to God. And instead, in his indulgence, in his indifference, in his irreverence, he faces God's judgment. And whilst now the writing is on the wall, quite literally, in words that speak of judgment, there had been available to him for all of those years that letter, that open letter, that proclamation of Daniel chapter 4, the story of Nebuchadnezzar that he wrote down for all the people so that all the people could understand. He had that, and it was a story of grace and hope and repentance and restoration. But Belshazzar says, I ignored it. History had provided a wonderful lesson for him to learn from, but Belshazzar thought he knew better. He thought he could just ignore God. And by doing so, he seals his own fate. You know, there's a stark truth, isn't there? There's a reality that where there's no repentance, there's no forgiveness. And that isn't because, as Fry might say, God is capricious and mean-minded. It's not that at all. It's because God is holy and he's righteous and he's just. Let's read the last section, shall we, together? Let's read from the second part of 23 down to the end. Daniel is continuing his words. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Pharsin. Here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then, as Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Here's the last section for this morning. Mystery. Mystery. Prophecy. Mystery. You know, I think we could be forgiven for thinking that Belshazzar's decision to host an elaborate feast in his banqueting hall was some kind of celebration. It was some kind of party. Maybe it was a national event. Maybe it was the birthday of the queen. Maybe it was something similar. In reality, of nothing of the sort. It was nothing of the sort. It was merely a feast hosted by a king who thought he was invincible. For many months, the city of Babylon had been under siege. For many months, the army of the Medo-Persian Empire, commanded by Darius, was quite literally at the gate. Yet despite the prolonged siege, Belshazzar paid little or no attention to what was going on. And he simply said, "Let's party. Let's party. We are invincible. Let's party." Because of the high walls, because of the guard towers, because of the massive bronze gates, the people in the city thought that they were safe from the enemy. But nothing was further from the truth. Since Darius and his military strategists had hatched the most ingenious of plans. The city of Babylon was built over the river Euphrates. And you can imagine, of course, to some extent, that extended to Belshazzar that sense of confidence. We have a water supply. It's estimated that the city had food for 12 years. He wasn't worried. Why should he be worried about the army at the gate? But, as I said, Darius and his military engineers had hatched a brilliant plan. What they did over a matter of quite some time was they diverted the course of the river Euphrates. They diverted it such that it still flowed in part under the city, so that the people and the king had no idea what was being going on. But what it did was it left a dry water course for a whole army to march under the city and to invade and to take it. And whilst all of this was being prepared literally under their feet, Daniel's in the palace. He sets about explaining the story of the writing of the wall. He sets about saying what it means. And the words literally mean mina, shekel, and a half, the Aramaic. They're actually, they're descending values of coins. That's what they are. That's why, of course, the astrologers and whoever had no idea what was being presented by these words. It's a little bit like, if you're old enough, putting pounds, shillings, and pence up on the wall. What did it mean? Well, we discover, of course, that Daniel does know what it means because of he has been told by God. And there's an alternative writing because the roots of the words were the key. And the key was what was being alluded to. The words meant numbered, weighed, divided. And those three words spoke God's verdict on Belshazzar and his kingdom. And so the meaning of the mysterious Aramaic writing was revealed to everyone. And the consequences, by the early morning light, were known. And there's no mystery anymore. Because the city is taken, the king is killed, and Darius is ruling. But I think that chapter 5 does leave us with a mystery. You see, we know for certain the answer to the question that we've been considering all the way through this series about who rules. Is it kings and princes? No, it's not. It's God. And all authority, human authority, is subject to him. But I think the mystery comes in, why was it that Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar were treated completely differently? Why was it that Why did God humble the one into repentance and grace and restoration, but humiliate the other with only a few hours' notice of doom and destruction? You know, I think the text gives us a little bit of a clue. We get the hint in verse 22. This is what we read. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. There had been a significant period of grace, many decades, in fact, since the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar knew it, but he chose to ignore it. Last Sunday, Johnny quoted from Invictus, written by the Victorian poet William Ernest Henley. And in it, we read these words. Now, I think these words are one that Belshazzar would have wholeheartedly endorsed. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. About 570 years later, further on from this story, an itinerant Jewish rabbi from Nazareth went from village to village throughout Palestine telling stories. And one of those stories, one of those parables, reads like this. It comes from Luke chapter 12. It's one of the parables, in fact, that we thought about in our evening series quite recently. This is the story that was told. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God.'" So as we close and as we just think about the bread and the wine and we break it and we share it this morning, I think there's a question, something for us to consider about Daniel chapter 5. And it's a question about focus, and it's a question about priority. Are you, am I, and us together, individually, communally, being rich towards God? That's the question, I think, from Daniel chapter 5.